The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
So tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we're going to be talking to Maria Wheatley about Stonehenge, Earth Energies, and, well, a bunch of other stuff as well. How are you doing, Maria?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. And you're based in the UK, correct?
That's right. I'm based very close, actually, to the ancient sites such as Avebury and Stonehenge. I mean, Avebury's only about 5 or 10 minutes away from where I live.
Oh, wow. That must be nice.
It certainly is. I'm really in the thick of megalithic wonderland here.
All right. Most people know about Stonehenge. Why don't you tell people a little bit about Avebury?
Avebury contains the world's largest stone circle. It's a very vast ancient site. In fact, it covers about 3 miles of ceremonial landscape. So it has a stone circle, a massive stone circle of about 100 standing stones in a near perfect circle, around which is one of the UK's largest henge earthworks. And a henge is a ditch and a bank, like a mighty earthen circle just before the stone circle. It's not just a tip of earth. Just like the ancient Egyptians were using, you know, blocks of stone to build the pyramids, for instance, here in the UK, the Neolithic prehistoric people were building henge banks with chalk blocks. So it shouldn't be thought of as just a pile of earth. This is a brick wall going right the way around. And because we're in a chalk environment here, it would have gleamed chalk white amid a lush green landscape.
Hmm. Wow.
And furthermore, I mean, it's not just that 100 standing stones, inside of which were 2 very large standing stones containing about 30 standing stones each. It had 4 megalithic avenues, each containing around 200 standing stones, making a complex of about 900 to 1,000 standing stones.
Wow. So it's actually in some ways more impressive than Stonehenge.
It's more impressive than Stonehenge because it is vast. Very, very vast, and it contains very large megaliths. In fact, one of the megaliths weighs over 100 tons.
So are the stones bigger than those used in Stonehenge?
The stones of Avebury do differ very much from Stonehenge. Stonehenge has been made to look like lozenger shapes. They've been what archaeologists call dressed. That's mauled by other stones to make them smooth and flat. At Avebury, you have diamond-shaped stones, which are said to represent the feminine, yin. You have tall, column, phallic-like stones, which are said to represent the yang force. And they're quite natural-looking, so they haven't been worked or made to look like a lozenger shape.
Huh. So, is this the same place where the stones are actually all magnetized in the same direction?
According to John Burke's work, yes. So they do have high magnetic fields. And for instance, when you root a standing stone, be that at Stonehenge or indeed at Avebury, and you root it into a ley line or a grid line or an earth current, which we may have time to talk about later, when the stone is rooted into an earth energy, it starts to transmit and absorb the energy from beneath the surface of the earth. So in a way, they are highly magnetized and using very sensitive electromagnetic sensing equipment, Rodney Hale and myself, we discovered that these stones emit energy at certain points on the stone, of which there are 7, which can equate to our chakras. They're like megalithic chakras, if you will. And they're transmitting a signal around about 18 hertz, which is just below our ability to hear. We hear around about 20 hertz.
Huh. So you said that they mimic the chakras?
Yeah, there's 7 critical points, if you will, on a standing stone. And it mimics in a way and can be likened to our chakra system.
All right. How did you get into investigating all of this?
Well, my late father, he was considered one of the UK's master dowsers. And so I kind of got brought up with dowsing, and I'm a second generation dowser, obviously. And so I spend a lot of my time with my father and family going around ancient sites around the world, looking at their metaphysical properties, which was quite fascinating. And now I've decided, over the past 15 years or so, to really continue his work, to look at the mysteries that our ancient ancestors left behind, because they were aware of earth energy. In fact, I said that kind of chakra-like system of the standing stones that absorbs the earth energy and transmits it. It's almost like it's converting the earth, excuse me, the earth energy. My doctor stood on something. It converts the earth energy into an aerial form of energy. So I always liken that to visitors that come around the stone circles with me, to Neolithic Wi-Fi. They had no wires, but they were transmitting a hertz frequency, electromagnetic frequency across the land.
Huh. So it's almost similar to what Tesla was trying to do.
Absolutely. Our Neolithic ancestors were fully aware of the dynamics of the earth, the unseen earth energies, and they were tapping into it and harnessing it.
Okay. So you said you've gone all over the world looking at these sites. Do they all have similarities to one another?
They all seem to have particular design canons. Yes, they do. They do share similarities, although the shape and the design of a sacred site will kind of enhance certain types of earth energy, like the pyramid structure or dome structure or the circular structure. It's almost like our ancient ancestors were looking for particular types of earth energy, one of which is quite spectacular. There's an earth energy pattern, and it's like a spiral shape of seven coils. It's called a geospiral pattern, and it marks the esoteric center of most sacred sites. That could be the center of Stonehenge, for example, or Avebury, or indeed a pyramid. Now, this spiral pattern is generated by a particular type of underground water. Now, geologists tell us, rightly so, that when it rains, and don't we know it in the UK, when it rains, all the rainwater fills up the aquifers and it fills up the underground streams. And that's correct. But water diviners such as myself, we say there's another type of water. It's a very sacred type of water, and it's generated deep within the body of Mother Earth, independent of rainfall. And this is sacred water. And where that breaks forth to the surface, that's your sacred spring. Where that water is poured, that's your holy well. And it emits a spiral pattern. And that's how water diviners know they've doused for that particular type of water. And our ancient ancestors were placing their sacred sites above these sacred aquifers. Not any aquifer, but the sacred aquifers generated by the earth.
So, is it the same water, it's just in a sacred area?
No, it's not the same type of water. Water that has fallen from the sky, from the clouds, fills up the some aquifers and underground streams, for instance. That's kind of like yang water. It comes from the sky. The sacred inner waters of the earth, water diviners believe, is generated independent of rainfall by the earth itself.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting idea. How would the earth generate water?
Well, when we think about it, the earth can generate very diverse forms of substances from, for example, from oil to sulfur, gold, minerals. So why not water? It's got all the chemical compounds in which to do so. And in fact, in New Scientist magazine just 2 years ago, they were questioning where's the underground water coming from, because when they were putting dyes down into aquifers, some of the dye was going down quite deep indeed. And this is where someone like myself, a water diviner, would say, that's because you've hit a very independent body of water. These are special aquifers. And interestingly enough, they, like the standing stones, emit a particular type of hertz frequency. And it's around 7 to 10 hertz, which equates to what's called the Schumann resonance. It's like a background earth frequency, if you will, a natural resonance that the earth makes. Now, our brains, when they're in 7 to 10 hertz, we're in an alpha, relaxed mode. So these energy patterns emitted by the earth The harmonic surface pattern of this special type of water can also allow us to be relaxed and our brains to go into alpha mode. And I think that's another part that our ancestors were looking at, how certain environments, like a stone circle, can change your consciousness.
Yeah, well, that's something that's fascinated me for a while now, is that these places seem to do just that. They seem to interact with our consciousness in ways that we don't understand from our current science.
Absolutely. I mean, one very good experiment was conducted, I think it was about 15 years ago, by someone called Maxwell Cade. And he had developed the mind mirror. And that's where you put electronic nodes onto your scalp, so it will register the left brain and the right brain and the kind of patterns and frequencies and hertz that the brain is emitting. And they went to a stone circle in England, in Oxfordshire actually, called the Rollright Ring. And what they found was, wherein this mind mirror, as he called it, and recording the brain waves, certain people at certain times of the day, as they walk towards some stones, their brains would literally go into that alpha mode in a very deep, relaxed state. So even interacting, walking towards some standing stones, can affect our brain patterns.
Do you think that's just because of the energy they're giving off?
I think it's the energy it's given off by what I described earlier, absorbing the earth energy and then transmitting it. But the shape of a circle has been renowned for many, many years to be sacred in itself. I mean, for example, occultists of old used to draw a protective circle on the ground, be that of salt, be that of whatever. The pattern of a circle alone, known to dowsers, generates a force field. It generates lots of concentric circles around it. It's deemed protective. That's why when your old-fashioned occultist draw his circle of salt on the ground, it would then generate what's called form energy. And that form energy would ripple out across the landscape, protecting all in its wake.
Huh. Okay, well, let's talk about dowsing for a moment. I've never been sure what to make of dowsing myself. I've had very little experience with it. I know T.C. Lethbridge, I know, wrote a bit about it and tried to make it more scientific. And I know some ghost hunters and stuff who swear by it. And I was talking to someone recently who has witnessed map dowsing and was very impressed with it. Can you get into a little bit about what dowsing is and how it works?
Everybody and anyone can douse. It's a really simple skill to master. An easy way to start dowsing is to literally buy yourself some what we call L rods, that like an L shape, and you can literally walk around your house and you'll start picking up on things like underground water, your sewage pipes, and utility pipes, and that type of thing. So everybody can douse. It's the real skill of dowsing is interpreting that which you found. That's the main thing. So you have to start to be able to differentiate between certain energies, but that can be built up over time. So, for example, when I'm dowsing, I would hold two L rods and I would start to look for one particular thing at any one time. So I would gently command my rods, for instance, to show me the nearest underground stream, if that's what I wanted to find. And the rod would start to waver in a particular direction, then it would stop, and then you literally walk towards the rod where the rod is showing you, and when it crosses, that normally means found, it's found its target, so the underground stream would be beneath my feet, for example. And you can repeat that for grid lines, for example. Grid lines is a very good thing to douse for, because imagine that the earth is surrounded by a giant net, a giant grid. And in the 1950s, Dr. Manfred Curry discovered a particular grid system called the Curry grid, well, after him. And what he found was that the crossing point of grid lines would become very, very toxic, and it would affect your blood, it would affect your health. In fact, long-term exposure to the crossing Curry grid lines would be very detrimental to your health. And in some parts of Germany, you get a certificate from, if you want to sell your house, say, my house is geopathic stress-free, meaning my house isn't having any grid crossing lines. And if it has, you would then move your furniture away from it so you're in a grid-free position. Because it was found in Germany over a seven-year study that a quarter of most hospital admissions were down to geopathic stress. simply living above underground streams, which is not conducive to good health, or indeed your bed being placed above the crossing line of a curry grid. So for me, dowsing has very practical applications so that we can live in harmony within our homes and within our environment.
Well, how do you think it works? Is it something our unconscious picks up on that we have to tune into? Is it the actual dowsing rods interacting with the environment?
When it comes to dowsing for something like underground water or grid lines, I think it's in all probability a bit of a reflex brain reaction to that which you have found. But that doesn't explain map dowsing, for instance, where, I mean, you just mentioned that a few minutes ago. Map dowsing, where you can find something that is a remote target that has no physical link to it. So I think there's something that enhances our sixth sense when we douse. And I've certainly map doused for Bristol University. I found their meteorites quite quickly through map dowsing, and it really, really does work.
It seems like it's kind of an extension of remote viewing almost.
Yeah, it's remote dowsing, actually. That is quite right. It's like remote viewing, but you're using normally a pendulum and a map to find a particular target, as we would call it. So that's one way you could use dowsing to find, you know, hidden or lost objects, for example. You could also use it for your health to check, you know, your chakra system, which remedies would be best for you, the kind of substances you're allergic to. So there's specialist in health dowsing, for example.
Okay. Now, is Germany the only place doing this with the energy?
I think in Germany they're quite advanced dowsers, and they really look at the relationship between where you live and your health. And that's a really interesting concept, because in the UK, and obviously I can't speak for America, but in the UK we just take for granted that where we live is okay for us, and it really isn't. And some places are far more toxic than others. I mean, for example, living above underground water, that is yang water as I call it, the water that's fallen down from the sky and is filled up the aquifers and the water table, that emits a really, really high Hertz field. Long-term exposure to underground streams is carcinogenic. It must be avoided, or it must be diffused if you live in that environment. So even if we do live above grid lines or underground streams, there are many remedies that we can apply to ease the force of the Hertz signal.
Like what?
You can buy a diffuser, a good old-fashioned rock salt lamp, for example. They're very inexpensive. That naturally starts to throw out negative ions, and negative ions are very good for us, actually, because grid lines, it's been found through Russian research, because again, the Russians and the Germans, they're quite advanced in their understanding of Earth's grid systems and Earth energies. They found the crossing points of especially the curry grid would start to release high levels of positive ions, and they're not good for us. I mean, just about when that thunderstorm is looming over us and people get headaches, they feel tired and lethargic, that's because the air is filling up with numerous amounts of positive ions. And yet, after the storm, when the thunderstorm has gone, the air feels crisp and it feels clean. That's because it's filled with negative ions. So a good old-fashioned rock salt lamp, that's what it does. It throws out a negative ion field, which would diffuse any crossing points of the grid.
Okay. Does it matter what the dowsing rods and such are made out of?
Not at all. You could literally get, you know, a pair of dowsing rods made from an old-fashioned metal coat hanger. They would find something. You could buy them from a New Age shop or buy them from a local dowsing society. And one of the most traditional forms of dowsing rods is an old-fashioned hazel rod. It's in like a Y shape. And that will start to push down and then pull up under pressure of finding underground water. It's a time-honored way of finding that substance. So dowsing rods differ, and they can be very accurate as long as you say to your rod in a gentle command what you're looking for. Because if I was just had a pair of dowsing rods, for example, I'm wandering around the countryside, or even in my own house, and my rods find something, they cross and say, I found something. Well, what is it? Is it a grid line? Is it underground water? Is it a ley line? Is it an earth current? You have to then find out what it is you're dowsing for. So my first rule when I teach people to douse is ask the rods, gently command the rods to show you one thing at any one time. It's the best way to start dowsing.
Now, are these grid lines the same as ley lines, or are they two different things?
Grid line, the Curry grid, discovered by Dr. Manfred Curry, is a particular type of grid. Easy to identify because it always, at most latitudes, comes in at between 45 degrees west of north or 50 degrees west of north. And it's a grid that is spaced, roughly speaking, every 3.5 meters. So it's easy to identify. Once you go into somebody's house, you just look for about 45 degrees west of north. You cross that at a right angle. If your rod crosses, then that's the Curry grid. And then you follow that line until it crosses again, and that's the crossing point. It's very simple to douse and can really be a good way of ascertaining whether your bed is in a good position or not. Signs of geopathic stress, for example, let's say you don't know if your bed's on the crossing point of the Curry grid lines. Certain signs will tell you that you probably are. For example, you could wake up a lot with night sweats, you know, you could grind your teeth a lot, you could wake up feeling tired, and you have a kind of apathetic attitude, you suffer from night chills or nightmares. That's all hints of geopathic stress, and especially waking up about 3 o'clock in the morning, that's when geopathic stress is at its peak.
Now, why is that?
Theories abound, actually. One theory is that it's very still at that time in the morning, so you can pick up on it more easily than the hustle and bustle of during the day. Or it could be associated with celestial forces, such as the position of the sun and the moon on the horizon line, or above or below the horizon line.
Okay, and the difference between that and ley lines?
Well, ley lines is a very generic term. So you can have a short ley line, which could be, say, between 1 and 3 miles long. And a ley line is defined by having at least 5 sacred sites lined upon it in a dead straight line. That's what Alfred Watkins in 1925, when he discovered the ley line system of the UK, that's how he defined it. Some ley lines can stretch for mile after mile after mile. One of the well-documented British leys is called the St. Michael Lane. It comes in Cornwall in the west. It transverses across the countryside to the east coast. It's 300 miles long. And Avebury Henge, that stone circle we were talking about that contains the world's largest stone circle, is at the exact center of that ley line. And there are numerous other sacred sites lined upon it. That ley line also faces, or it did in the Neolithic, the rising of the Beltane sun. And the Beltane sun is the old Druid equivalent of the May Day sunrise. So it's almost like some ley lines are engineered to face a celestial event. Some ley lines have energy, for example, which you can douse, and they're very strong. So we visualize them as having an electromagnetic signal flowing through the land. And some don't have any energy, so they're very diverse ley lines. And then you can get what's called a ley system. And these are truly fascinating. Now, ley system was discovered in the 1980s by the authors, the late Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst. And basically, they were wanting to douse that ley line I've just described, the St. Michael line, that 300-mile long ley that courses east-west across England. And what they found was, In coiling that ley line in a Caduceus-like fashion were two currents of energy, like mighty rivers, coiling around the ley line in a serpentine fashion. One was very strong and one was more gentle. When they looked into these earth currents more, they found that remarkably, every 10 miles along the gentle, meandering current was a church dedicated to Mary Magdalene or the Virgin Mary. And they called this energy current the Mary line, the Mary current. And on the stronger, more male energy current, they found, again, roughly every 10 miles or so, a church dedicated to St. Michael or St. George. So they called it the Michael line or the Michael current. So some ley lines have these entwining rivers of energy encoiling them. Now, in ancient Britain, we didn't write anything down. We were a bardic people. We passed our knowledge through the spoken word. It wasn't, in fact, until the Romans occupied us that they wrote our history down for us, and quite wrongly so at times. But nonetheless, in ancient China, around about 2200 BC, they were documenting these forces, and they created a whole science to explain it, called Feng Shui, or Feng Shui, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And what they noticed was when these two currents crossed was especially potent, and where they crossed was reserved for the emperor's palace, or tomb, or temple. And they called them Long Mei, the dragon's breath, the power in the land. So this system was widely documented and it was used throughout the ancient world. Most temple spaces, whether it's in China or whether it's at Stonehenge or Avebury, tend to be aligned on these massive rivers of force.
Okay, and that was what I was just going to ask you about, the fault lines and earth energies, and like Paul Devereaux's work on this as well.
Yes, well, Paul Devereaux, I mean, he looked and researched into the relationship of fault lines and some ley lines. And what some fault lines emit are like a luminous ball of light, which he called an earth light. And today they're often called balls of light, or bowls for short. What Devereaux discovered was that in, especially where I live, near Avebury and Stonehenge, we have a chalk environ, and they do create fissures, and they do create fault lines, small fault lines. It doesn't matter whether it's a small fault line, like in the chalk, or a large fault line, like you have running through San Francisco, I think. These lines do channel energy, so fault lines are intimately associated with ley lines. It's very interesting when we look back to our example, which I called the St. Michael Ley, that had those two currents entwined in it. In 1275 in England, we had an earthquake, and all of the chapels and churches sited upon that ley line toppled. So it goes to show that that ley line was intimately associated in part with the fault line system.
Interesting. All right, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be back with Maria Wheatley in 45 seconds.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we're talking tonight with Maria Wheatley, and we've been talking about earth energy and such. And I want to give people your website real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's www.theaveryexperience.co.uk.
Okay, and you have two books out. Avery, Sun, Moon, and Earth, and The Essential Dowsing Guide, correct?
That's right. The Essential Dowsing Guide is available in America through Ozark Mountain Publishing. And that's a publishing company run by Dolores Cannon, who's famous in America for past life regression work.
Okay. What about the Avery one? Is that available over here?
That's available in the States via Amazon.
Okay. The other one's not on Amazon?
Yes, I believe the Essential Dowsing Guide is on Amazon as well as Ozark Mountain Publishing website. And it's available on my website as well.
All right. And that was originally written by your father, wasn't it?
That's right. My late father, he studied dowsing for many, many years, and he took the writings of people that you mentioned earlier, Lethbridge, Tom Graves, and another master dowser called Guy Underwood, and he kind of synthesized all of their work and put it together into one book, and that's the Essential Dowsing Guide. Because my father came into possession of a lot of unpublished manuscripts and surveys by a master dowser called Guy Underwood. And Guy recorded the ancient landscape just after the Second World War. And he recorded many lost sites around the Stonehenge environs that are truly remarkable and sadly ended up underneath the plough. And one of my research topics is the ancient sites that surround Stonehenge, for example. Because what Guy noted was that close to Stonehenge, for example, was once a truly magnificent monument. The monument was recorded in 1723 by an antiquarian called William Stukeley, and it defies all logic. Imagine about a quarter of a mile away from Stonehenge, looking towards the northeast, that there's this gigantic earthwork. The earthwork was bricks of chalk, like I described earlier, rising to about 10 feet high, transversing the landscape from east to west, running for 2 miles, or nearly 2 miles, 1.75 miles, this gigantic structure. So it's a couple, it's about sort of 30 meters wide in place. It's gigantic. It's 2 miles long. It contained no entrance. Not for humans, anyway. You could not enter the Cursus Monument, as it's called. It truly is a very unusual monument. And archaeologists, they explain everything through death rites. Yeah, whether it's the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, it's all about death. And they say, for some reason, the Cursus Monument that stood in front of Stonehenge, sadly now ploughed to oblivion, was about death. And it was about walking ceremonially up and down the 2 miles straight, you know, mourning your lost, you know, relative as such, all about death. But it cannot be because it didn't have an entrance. And how would you get into the Cursus Monument? How would you climb up 10 feet and then slide down? It's just a true nonsense to say that that is about death rites. That area was very, very unusual close to Stonehenge. And my late father and myself, we did a Geiger survey using a Geiger counter looking for cosmic radiation, background ionizing radiation. Right at the center of the Cursus Monument, the Geiger counter went mad. It was picking up on 3 to 4 times higher levels right at the center. And that is truly remarkable. It's almost like there was something still in the land or caused by that monument or associated with that monument that releases vast amounts of radiation, gamma radiation as well.
And when was this destroyed?
It was destroyed around about the 1800s.
Yeah. Would it have been in any way similar to the mounds that we find in Ohio and places in the Midwest?
Not at all. Very, very vastly different. This was like a container in the landscape. Imagine like a rectangular shape of brick walls 10 feet high with no entrance. That's what you're looking at. Not like a mound structure at all. So the inside, you could literally, should you have been able to have walked up and down there, it was a wide arena of space.
And what type of radiation were you picking up?
Gamma radiation, quite a destructive form of radiation, which makes me think, for instance, you know, were the prehistoric astronomer priests also prehistoric physicists? Did they know what they were generating in the land? Could they be generating some form of radiation? Could they be harnessing that? Could they have purified it? I mean, I really think we should now start looking at prehistoric man as being physicists, astronomers, scientists, and scholars.
Oh, definitely. I don't think there's any doubt that there was high technology back then. It's just not the type of technology we have today.
Exactly.
Now, how old do you think these sites are?
That's very interesting because again, when you look to an archaeological explanation of the ancient landscape in this country, well, indeed anywhere, go to ancient Sumer, they seem to come up with this date, 3000 BC, and everything seems to happen around 3000 BC. So, for example, the first phase of Stonehenge is 3000 BC, the first phase of Avebury is 3000 BC, and that's because they found grains of carbon, which they could carbon date, in particular areas of Stonehenge, and they chose that date, 3000 BC, because it registered in carbon with that. But recently, only a few years ago, some archaeologists were re-examining a stone hole at Stonehenge that no longer has a stone in it. It's like the remnants of where a stone was placed. And they dug down quite deep and they got some charcoal. And that's like the holy grail to an archaeologist. Yeah, we can get a date. We can carbon date this. So they found it. They took it to the laboratory and they come up with 7000 BC. But they don't choose to announce that date because it doesn't fit in with their mindset and understanding. And there are places around the Stonehenge environment that date back further than that, to about 10,000 years old. And I think, given a little bit of time, some new blood coming into the archaeological arena, then they will see these monuments are far, far older than what we're led and spoon-fed that their dates are 3000 BC. Clearly they are not.
Well, 10,000 years ago would put it right at the end of the last ice age, wouldn't it?
Well, the ice area around Stonehenge, the ice pact, rather, in the Stonehenge environment didn't come down to Stonehenge. Hmm. So that was always ice-free, actually. They've discovered that recently. So Stonehenge would have been quite a fertile area, even in a cold climate. They know that through snails. Snails are great little archaeologists, actually, because some snails like wooded environments, some snails like open plain land, for instance, and some snails like rotting flesh. So it tells you a lot about the landscape. And in the Stonehenge and Avebury environment, it says clearly that there was no trees, it was quite a fertile open plain land.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, this could be from a previous culture. I mean, if there was an advanced culture on this planet, they could have had something directly to do with building Stonehenge.
Well, yes, and even before Stonehenge, which we tend to call the Neolithic period and the Bronze Age, for example. But before that, you had Mesolithic people, and we tend to think of them and call them hunter-gatherers. And they were from about 10,000 BC to 8,000 BC. But in the Stonehenge area, what they found recently through archaeological excavation is that they had settlements. So again, we've really got to kind of think, well, they are hunter-gatherers because they had settlements. And where you find Neolithic monuments, like the old Long Barrows, your first phases of stone circles, well, they lie directly above far, far older Mesolithic settlements or activity. And there's no way those people would have seen that which is beneath the ground, because the ground layer rises, doesn't it, with, you know, leaves falling on it, grass growing. That's why we need to dig down when we use archaeological techniques. So how did those people in the Neolithic know that thousands of years before them, there was an ancient structure there? There must have been a history of the area handed down. There must have been knowledge of the area and continuation of some kind of association of the families wanting to reoccupy sacred space, temple space.
One of the things you talk about, I think you did a tour where you were talking about the churches and cathedrals conforming to the same type of energy patterns that some of these ancient sites did.
Yes, you see, in the UK and Europe, the Neolithic and the Bronze Age people, the stone circle people, if you will, they handed down the knowledge to the Druid masters. And the Druids kept that knowledge alive, and they built ceremonial centers, which we call hill forts, which even now have been evaluated as ceremonial centers, because some of them are non-defensive. Some of them are defensive, but most of them are not. The Druids then handed down the wisdom to the Templars, for example, and in turn the Templars handed it down to the Masons, and the Masons handed it down to the Mystery Schools and the Bilderbergs, or whatever you want to call them. So when we look at the Templar phase, for example, they too liked the circle. They were looking for that geospiral pattern, that circular type of earth energy that decrees sacred space, and they would site part of their temples around that. The Templars also looked for what's called the geocross, and that's where you get an energy line, that could be a ley line or an earth current we were describing earlier, and it flows down the axis line, for example, the church east-west, then it's crossed somewhere at a right angle with another energy line, and that creates a sacred cross in the landscape that consecrated the ground for the church to be sited upon. At Glastonbury Abbey, for example, Hamish and Paul, what they discovered was the Mary and Michael lines cross at the high altar of Glastonbury Abbey, which is a very sacred part of the inside of the cathedral. The high altar is a very special place. And the energy lines cross there. It's the geocross in the landscape. So that's what they were looking for. And also in the UK and Europe, some of the graveyards are always circular. And sometimes when you're driving around an old country lane in the UK, you have to really divert around the church in a big circular swing. And that's because surrounding the geospiral pattern, you have like a halo. It's a really powerful energy band, like a concentric circle you can visualize it as. And you could have the esoteric center of the church with the sacred water there, and then you could have the halo pattern decreeing the boundaries of the churchyard. And we must think about how the Templars and the early Christians used church. They didn't have pews. They didn't sit in a church. That's a very modern contribution. Mainly down to money, actually. If you were rich, you get a front pew. And if you were poorer, hey, you'll sell at the back. A bit like a kind of theatre now. And that's why that came into being. But traditionally, you would walk around the church in a processional manner, just like you would a stone circle, an ancient pagan site, and you would be following the energy lines. Now, there's an ancient Templar rite where when you go, I don't know if you know European churches at all, but there's always two doors to most cathedrals and most churches. The door is split into two. It's normally an arch door split into two. And that represents the whole of you. Now, for most people, like you and I, when we go into church, one side's closed and one side's open. One's locked. You can only go access the church through one half of the door. When a bishop or high-ranking official comes to town, as it were, both doors are swung open because it represents wholeness. And they would walk a particular route, like the ancient Christians would have done, around the church to, on that holy geocross I explained earlier, to enhance their understanding of God, of consciousness. They're walking on an energy line. They would then go to a particular point in the church which has what's called a power point, where it kind of releases a lot of earth energy, and they would stand upon that. And research coming out of Europe suggests, well, they did like before, during, and after pictures, you know, makeup shots in a way. So you'd stand on the power point, you'd have a photograph of your aura taken before, during, and after, and they found, just like the dowsers of old have always said, it expands your aura tenfold. But intriguingly, 3 minutes on a power spot is all you need, because 4 days later, 4 days later, your aura is still expanding. Now, if you can attune that to your consciousness as well, well, then your consciousness is expanding for 4 days. And that's truly remarkable. That is how earth energy can stay within our auric and chakra systems.
Now, does sacred geometry play into all this as well?
Well, absolutely, because once you have the living earth force, the living, breathing earth in her patterns of force or her lines of force, then you can place your sacred geometry on top of that to enhance and to enhance and to enhance. But if you haven't got the living earth force to begin with, your sacred geometry is still going to be very special, but not as special when it is in conjunction with the energy of Mother Earth. And that, put those two together, and then you truly have heaven on earth. You have sacred temple space.
Okay. How were these sites, these ancient sites like Stonehenge and stuff, built, do you think?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. With great difficulty in our terms. I think we look at it and we think, oh, it's very, very difficult to do that. But weight was not an issue to the builders of Stonehenge. Now, where I live in Marlborough, near Avebury, is very close to what's called the Valley of the Stones. And the Valley of the Stones is a natural sarsen deposit. Sarsen is the name of the stone that's used at Stonehenge and Avebury to make the standing stones. Of natural sarsen deposits in the land. Now, if weight was an issue for the Stonehenge builders, for instance, they would have shaped the stones in situ of where they found the stones, but they didn't. If they did use the heave-ho method, which is truly far too primitive, they took them all over these huge hill ranges that lie between where I live and Stonehenge. Well, you'd think, well, if they'd shaped them first, they could have taken off quite a bit of tonnage in shifting them, but they didn't. They shaped the stones and made them lozenge shaped near Stonehenge. So weight evidently wasn't an issue.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, are you familiar with the Coral Castle?
Yes, I am.
Do you think that he may have tapped into whatever they used to move and make these rocks perhaps lighter?
That's the key. It's making the rock, as you said, lighter. Because myself and a co-author of Avebury Sun, Moon and Earth, Busty Taylor, we've been looking at what's called nodal points on the stones. My late father lectured about them extensively. And just imagine on a standing stone or any stone laid down, there's like a really sensitive point, a bit like it's Achilles' heel, so to speak. If you start interacting with that part of the stone, something very strange starts to happen. So imagine that you're leaning on the stone, for example. The stone will make you feel like you're being pushed into the stone or you're being pushed away from the stone. It's quite a remarkable experience. Well, Busty's a pilot and he works at a local airfield, and we were thinking about getting some equipment, for example, that can register weight, really finite weight, because they test planes there and you have to know about weightlessness and all different things to make sure the plane is, you know, fit to fly, as it were. So we used some very sensitive equipment, and what we were finding when we were interacting with those nodal points, that it would make you, leaning against the stone, suddenly gain weight. So you could literally be leaning against the stone and you would say you would start off at, I don't know, 11 stone or something. Within 6 to 7 seconds, you would go up to 16 stone.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very remarkable. And the other way as well. So for some people, you could literally put on weight really very dramatically, very quickly, according to the weight measuring equipment, or you can be made lighter. And for me, when I was interacting with the stones, I've always felt a force on the nodal point push me away from the stone or make me feel lighter. And when I was rigged up to the equipment, I was losing pound after pound after pound very quickly. When I was only interacting with that nodal point. Now, if our ancient ancestors were aware of that, they were fantastic stonemasons. That was their medium. They knew an awful lot more about stone than we probably do today. I think they could interact with that special area, that little Achilles heel on the stone, and use that as a form of transportation. It would make it lighter for them. So weight, again, wasn't the issue.
Well, what made you even think to check that? Like that it could cause a weight gain or loss?
Well, my late father, he studied stone in the eyes of what he thought was the ancestors. And he was one of the first to kind of look at the kind of chakra system on the stones. roughly speaking, at first quarter of the moon, which is about 6 or 7 days after new moon, 6 or 7 days after full moon, you have last quarter. That's a critical point in Earth energies. It's where any Earth energy pattern will kind of start to turn in the other direction or flow in the other direction. And especially with standing stones, they're enhanced. And on those times of the lunar cycle, that's when you can push your hands against the stone. And this is what we were doing. This is how we kind of, you know, stumbled upon the effect. We started to interact with the nodal points at the times of the lunar cycle and realized that's when it's at its strongest and its most powerful. And we were at Stonehenge when my father was alive with the group in the late 90s and having a really great time. You could touch the stones at Stonehenge then. You can't now. They're really disempowering that monument. But anyway, we were up there, we were touching the stones, and there was this lovely chap with us. And he was one of these pagans who wore lots of jewelries, pentacles and rings of dragons, and lots and lots of metal was on him. Now, when he interacted with that critical nodal point, the next minute he was flung about 10 feet away from us. And we were aghast, thinking, oh gosh, I do hope he hasn't hit his head on the stone. You know, really quite worried for the poor chap. And the only thing that was different for him was the amount of metal on him. So we think that metal's a conductor, isn't it? It's a really good conductor. And somehow that enhanced and that really flung him away. Again, for him, when that stone, weight wasn't the issue.
Huh. So you can't actually touch the stones in Stonehenge any longer?
No, even on private access, and that's where you book your private tour of the stones so you can access the inner sanctity of the stone circle. English Heritage now are refusing permission to even touch the stones. It's a really, really sad state of affairs, because only a few years ago you could touch the stones, you could feel this, what I'm trying to describe to you now. You could interact with the stones, you could interact with the energies there. Now that's banned. And furthermore, it's almost like they're really trying to disempower Stonehenge, because English Heritage advise you to walk around the monument in an anti-clockwise motion when Stonehenge is a sun-orientated monument, and you should be walking around clockwise to feel and interact with the energy.
Do you think that's intentional on their part?
I think it's intentional.
Huh. I heard something about Disney building a hotel right by it or something.
Well, there was a chap called Disney who is one of the contractors, but not of Walt Disney fame, a namesake. That's what I've been told by a lot of researchers in the area. But nonetheless, they are truly changing Stonehenge, because just a few months ago, if I wanted to go there by myself or with the group or with my daughter, whatever, I could park very close to Stonehenge and I could get out, I could walk the landscape, and I would have a certain amount of freedom. I might not be able to touch the stones, but I could walk around the landscape.
Right.
From October this year, you will no longer have that right. You have to go to the visitor center, then you have to go onto their land train to take you to Stonehenge.
Huh.
That's the problem.
They've made sure they can make as much money off of it as possible.
Yes. So in a way, that is going a bit like Disney. I'm sorry to say.
Now, earlier we were talking about these geospirals, and I assume you detect those through dowsing. Is there any way to detect them in any other way? Like any other scientific instruments that can pick this stuff up?
Well, yes. You can obviously detect it through dowsing, because you're looking for a dowsable pattern. It's called pattern recognition of the spiral. But I'm always joined quite frequently at places like Avery, Rollwright and Stonehenge by a chap called David Webb. David has some very sophisticated sensing instrumentation. He's very scientifically minded. And so I would say to him, this is a pattern, say this is a geospiral, use your equipment and see what you're picking up. And what he has found time and time and time again is that particular frequency, which is 7 hertz, that really relaxing alpha frequency, and an awful lot of negative ions, pouring out of the ground, literally like a shower. So when you're over certain points at Stonehenge, at Avebury, or any sacred site that has the geospiral pattern, you're being bathed in negative ions. You will go away with a feel-good factor. And also, geospirals are said to be very healing. I mentioned the Master Dowser Guy Underwood earlier. And Guy, he talked to a lot of war veterans from the Second World War. And time again, they started to say a very similar story. When they were crossing, you know, France, getting ready to, you know, fight the enemy, so to speak, they were carrying heavy backpacks on them. And some of the soldiers would look to where sheep, horses or cows had previously lain, so you could see like a little indentation in the grass, if you will, and they would coopy down and they would sleep there. And that is often a sign of a geospiral pattern in nature. Wherever you see a lot of cows gathering, sheep sleeping, you can bet your bottom dollar that's going to be a geospiral pattern. And Guy spoke to the war veterans and they had a very similar experience. They would say that during the night, a woman would come to them. It could be their lover, their mother, their grand, their sister, or a woman figure, and say to them, "You're going to survive the war." And they would all get up, and their rheumatism would go. They would feel a lot better. And isn't it intriguing that on that kind of sacred water, water is always represented as a feminine element, if you will, a yin force, that kind of goddess-like figure would manifest in these soldiers' minds, just like Lourdes in France, very famous for its healing waters. Bernadette, when she started to scratch and paw at that ground, she did so guided by the Virgin Mary, who also manifested around that type of water. So I think on these places that manifest the geospiral pattern, they're geophysical arenas where we can get in tune with Gaia, we can get in tune with the Earth Mother and commune with her.
Are there paranormal experiences, you know, that people have in these sites?
Oh, wow, yeah. most definitely. Stonehenge, time and time and time again. I mean, in my research, I've often spoken to military personnel because Stonehenge is surrounded by umpteen military bases, all of which encircle Stonehenge. There's over 10. Now, some of the military personnel, they go to a particular track that's quite close to Stonehenge, and they would go there with, we call them, a couple of tinnies, you know, like tins of beer and some cigarettes, and chill out, not to get drunk, but just to, you know, chill and be away from barracks. And their barracks is at Lark Hill, which is only a mile and a half away as the crow flies. And their experiences is quite remarkable. They say they were in the car and all of a sudden this amber light started to rise right in front of the car. It was almost like playing with their minds, because it would suddenly appear vastly away from them in the distance, or next minute, literally in a second, it would appear right by the windscreen. So they would try to triangulate where this light was coming from. Anyway, it disappeared and they decided to go back to barracks. And when one of the chaps scratched his face, he realized he had a lot of stubble. They arrive at Lark Hill Barracks and they're reprimanded because they've been absent without leave. And they're saying, "Well, you know, we've only just gone down the road for a couple of tinnies and a smoke." They say, "No, you've been gone for 48 hours. You're in the can, basically, for being absent without leave." So Stonehenge, yeah, that's quite a common story from around the Stonehenge area. Time loss, something strange and really paranormal happening to people within that environment.
Wow. All right. Well, we're almost out of time. Once again, give people your website.
Yeah, sure. It's www.theavebryexperience.co.uk. That's co.uk.
All right. And do you have any tours or anything else coming up?
Yes, so you can always look on my website. I've got some tours coming up next year, actually. We'll be going to Scotland and Ireland and, of course, the wondrous Stonehenge. And we do get private access to go into Stonehenge. And even though you can't touch the stones, I always make sure that we do.
Okay. And your two books, Avery, Sun, Moon, and Earth, and The Essential Dowsing Guide, are both available on Amazon as well as your website?
Yes, The Essential Dowsing Guide is available on Amazon, on my website, I've previously mentioned, and on Ozark Mountain Publishing website as well, available in the States.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for this fascinating conversation.
You're welcome.
And is there anything else people should know that we didn't get to?
Well, I would say really just have a go at dowsing. Look up on Google about the curry nets. Look to your own beds. Look to where you spend a lot of time in your own home. Look for those grid lines and start to live in harmony with the earth. Your health will improve. You won't be suffering from geopathic stress. And you'll feel far more comfortable in the house in which you live.
All right. Well, thank you, Maria. And Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. And counting.